This is David Getoff, and the reason I'm recording this is because there has been such a, you could almost call it an explosion in the amount of research over the past not too many years and continuing, of course, into the future on the harmful effects of gluten, gliadin, wheat in general because of its content of gluten and gliadin. And so many people completely misunderstand both what's going on, how many things might be caused by these substances, how inadequate the testing is, that I just figured I have to make a tape on it. Gluten is a protein. Gluten is in many different grains. And I'm just going to, for this recording, we're just going to lump gluten and gliadin, which are the two agents that people are reacting to. We'll just lump them both together. There are also many different forms of gluten and gliadin. And many different types of grains. So let's start with the fact that it appears the reason that this has come to be is not because all of a sudden lots of people are simply developing a reaction to our wheat or to gluten or gliadin because of, chemicals in our environment or problems with genetic changes, which of course is not it at all. Instead, what's happening is that the agriculture in the U.S. is not being designed or modeled after a principle of let's make everything as healthy as possible. It would be nice, but it's not. It is instead modeled after a principle of let us make all of our agricultural plants that are used for animal or human consumption as productive as they can possibly be, more bushels per acre, resistant to different insects and different blights and different fungi as possible. Let's make them look really, really good so that the stupid consumer goes in and goes, wow, that's a beautiful tomato. Let me grab that. And then they bring it home and bite into it or take a slice of it and say, oh my goodness, that doesn't even taste like a tomato. It tastes more like a piece of cardboard. So what has happened is that as we do this, we end up turning the various different plants into things which the human bodies, ourselves, of course, on this planet, haven't been exposed to before. And as far as wheat is concerned specifically, that's really a biggie, we have created a major, major problem. And you could call it a sleeping giant because of how few people understand what's going on with U.S. wheat and gluten and gliadin. And the reason I say U.S. wheat is because I have many patients and I've met many other health professionals, and it's been lectured on at some of my conferences, where when they travel to Europe and consume some of the non-hybridized, more ancient, our current word for this is heirloom varieties of wheat, with one of the dominant ones being called Emmer, E-M-M-E-R, Emmer wheat, they don't end up having reactions. People that have major reactions, they can't eat a piece of bread because of any of a number of reactions we'll be going over on this tape, just one of which might be severe diarrhea. There are many others. And they go to Europe and for whatever reason decide to try a piece of bread over there. Maybe they go, oh, this is, hand-baked bread. I have to have some. So what? I'll have diarrhea for a couple of days. And they eat it and they have no reaction whatsoever. And they come back and they ask me what's going on. And, of course, the thing that's going on, so to speak, is that the reaction is not to wheat in general. The reaction is not to the molecules of different types of glutens or gliadins in general. The reaction is because we have turned these into substances that the body looks at, and if the body could talk, it would probably be saying, what the hell is that? That doesn't belong in me. That's not a food. You shouldn't be eating that. I'm going to react to it. Well, the body can't talk in those ways, but it can talk in other ways, which we'll go over a number of the different symptoms. So basically, it is really our wheat that is the dominant problem. However, once somebody becomes sensitized to the gluten and gliadin in our wheat, many of them also become sensitized to the glutens and gliadins in a number of our other U.S. grains, which have also been hybridized to various degrees. So, for example, spelt and kamut, that's S-P-E-L-T and K-A-M-U-T, are more ancient forms of our grains, but I have some people who can eat Spelt and Kamut without their reaction, and other people that have a lesser, but they still have a reaction. And so far, both of these classes of people or groups of people have not had a reaction to emmer. So it varies. And then, of course, you've got the fact that barley has gluten in it. And the question is, can you get an old, non-hybridized heirloom form of barley? Goldmine Natural Foods, for example, has some buffalo barley, some ancient heirloom forms of barley. And I have people that don't react to those, even though they do have gluten in them, or gliadin, or possibly both. So we really do have a problem. But the big issue here is if you are in the United States or any other number of countries where you're getting our types of wheat, of which there are many different varieties, but they've still all been screwed up with, you have a very large possibility of being sensitive to, intolerant of, whatever words you want to use. I'm not using the word allergy only because the medical profession has completely inappropriately and incorrectly, and as far as I'm concerned, in an invalid way, defined allergy. And they've defined allergy as an immunoglobulin E or histamine response to a foreign protein. And therefore, if you respond to anything without a histamine response, in other words, it doesn't stuff you up, it doesn't make your eyes tear, it doesn't do what we think of as a regular allergy, the doctor will correctly be able to, I guess not lie, he's just misinterpretation, to tell you that you're not allergic. Well, that's because the allergy is a defined term, and it's not an immunoglobulin E reaction. There are many different ways that our body can react to a substance that it doesn't like, so to speak. And if it's not the histamine reaction, if it's not the runny, watery eyes, stuffed nose, you know, et cetera, then it is not the type of reaction that has been defined by medicine as an allergy. So if a doctor says, no, I ran a test and you're not allergic to wheat, then, and you say every time you eat it you have a problem, please, please, please believe your body over the doctor. As a matter of fact, believe your body and your own eyes over almost everything that anybody can tell you. Even in medicine, the gold standard for determining whether a substance actually causes a reaction in an individual is called the provocation reaction, or the entire term is, it's not the entire term, but the entire method is that you are introducing the food after first having removed it for a long time. So in other words, the gold standard is that you remain off of the food you believe is an offending agent for a period of time. Usually you're best off with at least 4 weeks. Gluten can remain in the body for a lot longer than that time, so you might want to do 2 months, although it can stay longer than that. That's enough for most people. And so you remove it, and then you do an assault, or what's called a challenge, and you bring it back in again, and you see if there's a problem. The problem occurs, you stop it again, the problem goes away after a number of days, you challenge with the food again, it comes back again. That is the gold standard. Physicians are not using this gold standard anymore. Physicians have gotten very lazy, and what's happened is the way they're being paid, especially if they're in an HMO or a PPO, they don't have time to even explain to you what it would take to do this, or explain to you all the foods that you have to remove to be able to do this correctly. And so they run I could almost call it a silly allergy test of some type. It could be an immunoglobulin E panel. It could be a skin prick panel. It could be a RAST panel. It could be an ALCAT panel. It could be an ELISA ACT panel. There are a whole bunch of different ways that they can look at different reactions to the body. And then if you don't show allergic or reactive, let's not use their word, if you don't show reactive on the particular test that they show or that your other health practitioner runs on you, then they'll say, well, you're not intolerant of that substance. And that's not what they just found out. All they found out was of the thousands of ways your body can react to different substances, the particular one or two or three ways that they were monitoring, your body didn't react to. If you know you react, you know you react. And please believe yourself, as I said, over the doctor or anybody else. So what are some of the reactions? First, where are some of the places that gluten can hide? So, you know, how difficult if somebody says, okay, you know, David Getoff has been recommended to me as somebody that knows an awful lot. He's got a lot of information and he's helped a lot of people. I want to try what he's saying. What do I have to avoid? Well, the first thing is I recommend you get on a couple of websites. Put avoiding gluten into Google, you know, or Yahoo. I always use Google for searching. Put how to avoid gluten. Put gluten-containing foods, whatever you want, and you will find a number of websites that will give you pretty good lists of all of the things that gluten is in. And if it's a good site, it will then give you another list of many of the things that it may be in or some of the things that it is hidden in. So first of all, let me go over a couple of the reactions that you can have to gluten so that those people that are listening to this don't turn it off and say, why am I listening to all this information? I don't need this information. Yes, you do. Believe me, you do. So let's go over a bunch of the reactions. And then toward the end, I'll tell you some of the things that it's in because you can all go to any website and you can find that out. So I've been to numerous scientific conferences just in the last 2 years. I just got back from the International Association, International and American Association of Clinical Nutritionists. And this particular year, 2010, although this will never get old because this is not going to get any, this is not going to change. So if you're listening to this in 2012 or 2015, it doesn't matter. It's still just as appropriate and just as relevant. But we had four different professional lecturers, researchers, medical doctors, PhDs, lecturing on gluten intolerance and gluten sensitivity. And the total lecture time, I think, was just for those four lecturers came to something like 9 hours. So what do we know based on current, very properly done, often placebo-controlled, often blind research published in scientific journals, which the doctors have access to if they want to look, but that they in general don't know about? Well, one of the things that we know is that the majority of people that are reactive to gluten will not show up as reactive to gluten on the standard tests that the doctor will order, or that the naturopath will order, or that the clinical nutritionist will order, because the tests that we have are, let's say, sorely insufficient. And again, the reason is because there are many ways our body reacts, and there are very few that are being tested for. So if the doctor runs a test on you, and there are a couple of different ones, they could even do a celiac test where they're doing a biopsy of your intestine to take a look at the cells. They can do every single test available as of today, and today is August 23rd, 2010. They can do every single test as of today, and you could show up as not being reactive or having an intolerance to gluten, gliadin, or wheat. And yet, according to the research scientists that were presenting at the conference, that would be missing somewhere between 60 and 70%, in other words, the majority, of all the people that are, in fact, reactive to these substances and are being harmed by them and don't know it. So that's pretty sad. There is a new lab that's coming online sometime this month, and we'll take a look and see if that's as much better as people think it's going to be. They're supposed to have another 5 or 6 ways to test for it. That'd be great. I mean, I would love it if we could find maybe 80 or 90% of the people instead of 30 or 35. We're never going to be able to find them all, most likely, because there are always ways our body reacts to substances that it is reactant to or that it does not like, if that's the right way to put it, that we haven't yet determined the actual reaction and therefore cannot monitor it in a laboratory. So what are some of these reactions, and how do we know that there are so many that there are and yet which are not detectable? Well, because of the gold standard, where they do a provocation challenge after first having avoidance. So avoidance and then challenge, avoidance and provocation, like I said, is a gold standard. So they will take people who say that I know every time I eat, you know, a piece of bread or some pasta or a cake or a cookie or something that has gluten or gliadin in it, I have a reaction. And we're going to go over some of those reactions. And yet the doctor did this test, and the doctor did that test, and the doctor did this other test, and then he had a biopsy done. And then he told me, he said, no, it's all in your head. You're not really reacting to this. And I am getting sick and tired of physicians telling my students, my patients, or the public in general, that something is all in their head, when, in fact, if we had the technology, oh, I would love this so much, where we could put the physician's feeling inside the patient's body and vice versa, so that, let's say, for, oh, I don't know, 24 hours, we would switch brains. I'm not sure if we'll ever be able to have that technology. So many ignorant doctors that don't understand what's going on would go, oh my Lord, is this how you've been feeling? I am so sorry for telling you that it's all in your head. This is not in your head. This is very definite. I didn't feel this way until I just got inside to start feeling your body. And that would open the people's eyes. But we're probably not going to get that. And so they're going to keep sending people to psychiatrists. And if the doctor knows a little bit more, maybe a psychologist. But either way, that's rarely the problem. The problem is most likely biochemical. And there is a reason. And the reason is not a deficiency of a mood-altering pharmaceutical prescription drug that has never existed in your body. So what are some of these reactions? I know I've said that three times already. I have a tendency to ramble, but I'm not really rambling because I'm giving you information. So some of the reactions that people get, and again, what I was starting to say before, is the reason they know that only 30 or 35% can be found is because they take the foods away, these problems vanish, they bring them back, they come back, they take them away, they vanish. And these are on people in which every test done said there's no problem. But with the gold standard of removal of the food and then challenge, they prove that these things are really there. So the reactions vary. A small percentage of the reactions, we used to think it was all of them, we are wrong, small percentage of the reactions are GI or gastrointestinal reactions. In other words, a small percentage of the people who react to wheat, gluten, gliadin, are actually having a reaction somewhere in the gastrointestinal tract. So they may be having horrendous constipation, they may be having horrendous diarrhea, they may be having a combination of the two where it goes back and forth between them. I have particular patients where they will eat something that contains wheat, or gluten or gliadin, which might be in a different grain, but most often wheat. And within anywhere from 15 minutes to 2 hours, basically they poop in their pants. They can't control it. No matter, I mean, if they're in a car, they just soil the car. And after we eliminate the gluten, gliadin, wheat, you know, for usually as little as a month, some people take quite a bit longer than that to clear, these reactions start to demonstrably go away and they start to get better. They go, wow, finally somebody is helping me. Because, of course, the doctor ran a couple of tests very often and said, well, you know, it's not anything in your food. We can give you a drug that will basically reverse the diarrhea. In other words, we're giving somebody a constipating drug to be able to stop this. So only about 30 to 35%, according to current research, of the people who are reacting to these substances are reacting in a gastrointestinal way. And, of course, some of those will actually even show up on a test. They can take a look and examine the intestines, large or small intestine, usually the colon, and do a biopsy, which they sometimes do. And if they actually see specific things in the biopsy, then the person actually gets a diagnosis of the condition which we know is caused specifically by gluten, and they are then diagnosed as having celiac, C-E-L-I-A-C, celiac disease. However, again, we have this diagnosis, which is a definition. So once again, as I talked about definitions at the beginning of this for allergy, if somebody has a biopsy of the intestine and it doesn't show celiac, then you could be at five different specialists in a row, and every single one of these physicians would say, well, we've done the biopsy. I'm sorry, you don't have celiac. Fine. Okay, you don't have celiac. If you want to call celiac something that must have this exact indication in a biopsy, then you can say the person doesn't have celiac. Excuse me, though, they're having the same reactions. They're having the same problems. If they avoid wheat, gluten, and gliadin, it goes away. And that's what the patient wants to know. How do I get better? So again, 30 to 35% seem to be able to get tested for. A similar percentage, some yes, some no, are GI responses. And that leaves somewhere between 60 and 70% of the people who are reactive to these substances as not being a gastrointestinal reaction. So now we have an even further problem, because if it's not a GI reaction, the doctor doesn't even consider that it might be celiac or anything having to do with wheat. Of course, their tests are so bad for it, it might not help them anyway. So what are the other reactions? Well, the other reactions seem to be neurological. So since they've done this, these challenges now, where they've removed the food and brought it back on many thousands of people in many very well done published studies, research studies. These are not nonsense things. These are not published in Time magazine or the New York Times, you know, or Let's Live magazine. These are scientific journals, journals of gastrointestinal health. I don't have the titles in front of me. They were all given to us the other day. What they found is a lot of neurological problems. So, for example, there are people who have anxiety disorders or depressive disorders, where they've been, of course, obviously, referred to a psychiatrist and are very possibly on all sorts of psychiatric drugs, when the only problem they really have is an intolerance to gluten, gliadin, or wheat, a combination of thereof. And when they have removed all of these from their diet, somewhere between 2 weeks, very rare, 4 weeks, more likely, or a couple of months, everything changes, they are totally normal again. And of course, very often, they don't believe it. And obviously, of course, their physician doesn't believe it. And he says, it's all in your head, that's not possible. And if they're really strongly a holistically oriented person, they go, I'd like to stop the drug for a while, if they happen to be on a drug. And depending on the psychiatrist, he may allow them to, which is really weird, allow them to, they're not in jail. Or they may decide to do it on their own. I, for example, I'm not a physician, so I cannot tell one of my patients to stop a drug. But of course, if they decide to see how they feel, then, you know, that's certainly fine. They're allowed to do that. We're not in prison. We're not incarcerated. And, you know, they taper down the drug. If you do that, you have to ask a pharmacist or a physician how to do that, because certain drugs must be tapered down very, very slowly to not have reactions. I'm not going over that here because I don't do that. I am not licensed to do that. But they stop these drugs and they still feel perfect because the offending agent has been removed. And the doctor, of course, still doesn't believe it, and the patient really doesn't care whether the doctor believes it. If the patient is intelligent, maybe they might want to try it again, and maybe they might want to not bother. But in any event, anxiety and depressive disorders are two that are, I can't tell you how often. They've done a lot of research, but it's not like they've taken 10,000 people with anxiety and depression disorders to see how many of them go away when they take the gluten out. What they have done is they have checked with simply removing the foods and seeing what kinds of changes there were, and in some cases actually done what little testing we have available to simply prove that many of these people do have, even with our bad tests, testable gluten intolerances or gliadin intolerances. So we've got anxiety and depression. They found many cases, I don't know what the percentage is, it might only be 10%, but that's still a lot of people, with schizophrenia, that one of the triggers is gluten or gliadin. And so how many people out there with schizophrenia, if they were to have their diet totally altered to be a super healthy diet and pull these things out, would no longer be schizophrenic anymore? I can't tell you that. That would be a marvelous research study. Of course, we have to get people with funding interested in funding these various different studies. Again, and this is all neurological, again, we have people with, and this was presented at the conference, ALS, that's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease, MS, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's and other different forms of dementia and different types of memory problems. Quite a number of all of those have been shown to get either better or in some cases go away after enough months of no gluten or gliadin in the diet. There was one that was presented at one of the conferences I was at where this woman had multiple sclerosis. Had symptoms for many years. It was slowly getting worse and worse. She had been properly diagnosed, I believe, as at the Mayo Clinic. She had a brain scan. The MS lesions were clearly shown in her brain. And she became part of a gluten-gliadin trial for whatever reason. And after quite a number of months, gluten-free, gluten and gliadin-free, again, I'm using them interchangeably. Anytime I say free, I mean all of them. Her symptoms vanished. And it was very hard to believe, and because she was part of the study, they went ahead and got her another brain scan. And lo and behold, she no longer had her MS lesions. She was now no longer diagnosed with MS. Well, nobody could believe that this was possibly the gluten, so they did the gold standard, and they did a challenge, and they brought the gluten back in again. Her symptoms came back. The lesions slowly came back again. And, of course, she stopped it again and would never challenge again because it's much nicer to be healthy and not have MS. And so we have all these different things, and yet the public doesn't understand. So I have so many different people. So how about a couple of others? Some other disorders have to do with numbness and tingling in the body, or almost any kind of neurological problem might either be caused by or aggravated by the gluten. They have found that a number of other neurological poisons, such as mercury, which I've spoken about before, which most people are exposed to all over the place just in our environment, but some people even have it in their mouths because silver fillings are 50 to 52% pure mercury, that now we've got two things together. You've got mercury and gluten, and when you have the two together, it can make things even worse. So sometimes, you know, you address one first, you address the other second. What are some of the other things that they had gone over? Weight loss was another one. They found a number of people where as soon as they pulled out all of the gluten, the person was able to lose weight. And that therefore it was basically fouling up their metabolic process. There were quite a number of other conditions that they were finding. For example, almost every condition that is labeled as autoimmune. So we have lupus, we have Graves and Hashimoto's autoimmune thyroid. There are many, many different arthritis, many, many different conditions that are labeled as autoimmune conditions. And they found in a fairly substantial number of people, if they totally cleared out all of the gluten-gliadin products, in somewhere between 2 or 3 weeks, if they're lucky, like I said, you're normally not that lucky, or in other people, somewhere between 2 and 4 months worth of being totally gluten-free, all of a sudden, all of these problems started to slowly go away because the body was finally able to heal itself after being smacked over and over and over and over again. And it's very difficult to stay away from some of these things for that long because the example I generally give is if you had, oh, let's say you scraped up your leg or your arm. Let's say you scraped up your arm. And so you've got a bunch of scabs on your arm. And your particular automobile, every time you get out of it, without even thinking, you rub it against something in the door frame and you scrape off some of those scabs. Well, guess what? Those scabs aren't going to heal even if you only drive your car twice a week, because that means twice a week you keep on re-injuring that area. Well, the same thing is true with gluten and gliadin. Somebody will say, well, but I barely have that stuff. I've cut it out and really it isn't in my diet anymore, but every once in a while, once or twice a week, maybe I have a little. That means it never clears. And if your body is already sensitized to it, such as the person that's got a bunch of scabs on them, body is already reacting to this, all it takes is a very small amount to prevent the reaction from going away. And so you never get to find out what it would be like without it. So, you know, it's really something that you have to say, all right, I really want to know how much better I could feel. Sleep disorders, by the way, were another one. How much better I could feel if, I'm laughing, I see a couple of hummingbirds outside my window at my feeder that are arguing with each other. Beautiful ruby-throated hummingbird and another one with a green throat. Hummingbirds love to attack each other and scream at each other. But you absolutely have to clear this stuff out, and it is very difficult. So let's go over some of the places where you would find gluten and gliadin. And actually, to give them credit, just to make sure I didn't miss a couple that I wanted to cover, I'm looking at a list that I just printed off of www.theglutenfreechef.com. But you'll have to put it into Google because there are dashes in there. It's not just all one word, theglutenfreechef.com. So some of the foods that contain gluten, well, of course, obviously breads, cookies, cakes, rolls, etc. This includes rye bread, which has wheat in it, pumpernickel that has wheat in it, and actually rye has gluten in it. So even if it was 100% rye and had no wheat, the gluten is still there. Yorkshire pudding and any other kind of pudding that has bread in it. Pretzels, of course, cakes, any kind of stuffing that is used to stuff a bird, you know, such as during Thanksgiving. Muffins, pastries, pie crust, or any kind of crust. You can have a crust on something. You might have some kind of, it's some snazzy restaurants I've seen, custards and jellos that have a crust on the bottom. Well, that crust most likely has wheat or is made even exclusively from wheat. Biscuits, any kinds of cookies. Bulgur is a type of wheat, so that's definitely wheat. Durum wheat, red wheat, there's a bunch of different ones out there. They're all wheat. Crumb-type toppings, or the breads that are put on a salad, which are called croutons. Couscous. There's no such grain as couscous. Couscous is a form of wheat. It's something they do to wheat. So all couscous is wheat. Pizza, of course, is all wheat. Semolina flour is wheat. Durum flour is wheat. Scones are wheat. Any kind of substance that has any kind of breading or breadcrumbs in it. Many breakfast cereals contain wheat, although not all. All bran is full of wheat. The bran is from wheat. Spongy puddings, breadcrumbs, I mentioned already. Barley has gluten in it, and although some people might not react to the old, ancient forms of barley, if you were cutting it out, you cut everything out. You find out afterwards if there are some things you can bring back. When you're doing this, you cut it all out, so you don't have to do it more than once. Malted drinks, malt often has wheat in it. Muesli is a cereal that has wheat in it. There are a lot of places that have hidden wheats, such as hot dogs, sausages, luncheon meats, can often contain fillers that may have that in. Blue cheese and blue cheese dressings are often made with breads. Different types of gravies, and of course, for Jewish people, I happen to be Jewish, matzah and matzah meal. There's actually one substance called seitan, S-E-I-T-A-N. Seitan doesn't contain gluten. Seitan is gluten. Seitan is basically 100% gluten. It's used in many vegetarian diets as a form of protein, and it's used in many Asian restaurants as a non-vegetable protein. So in other words, you go in a restaurant and you buy something that's vegetarian and it's called mock scallops or mock chicken or mock duck. What you are getting is seitan, which is 100% gluten. A lot of people don't know that. They think it's a kind of tofu. It is not. Hydrolyzed vegetable protein often contains gluten. Baked beans, there's often gluten inside the tomato sauce. Farina, of course, has wheat in it. Many different types of meat and fish patties, they use that in there as a binding agent. And, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but soups and stews, soy sauces pretty much all have wheat except the one that says tamari, T-A-M-A-R-I, in which case you want the one that says right on the label, tamari sauce, wheat-free, and preferably also organic. Some mustards have wheat added to them. Some cheap brands of chocolate and different types of other syrups and licorice, and it's amazing how many different things it's in. So, you know, and some supplements, but more and more supplements now say on them, you know, wheat-free, soy-free, gluten-free, all the various different things, peanut-free because of how many people are allergic. There are even some lipsticks that actually have wheat in it as a thickening agent. So it's very, very hard to stay away from. And if you're going to stay away from it and you are also going to not make everything yourself, in other words, you're going to eat in a restaurant, it becomes even harder because many of the mixed spices they use, they throw the spices into some wheat. So that's what they use as a binding agent to hold all the spices together because you don't want the spices too concentrated. You want them to be able to be spread out more. So they take some wheat flour or some flour, which is wheat flour. Doesn't matter whether you say white flour is wheat flour, wheat flour is wheat flour, whole wheat flour. They all come from wheat. So it doesn't matter whether we call it white or wheat or whole wheat. Those all come from the wheat plant. And so, you know, basically, almost any time you're talking about a bread made of flour, unless it's specifically some other gluten-free product, such as, you know, rice bread, which I don't even like the taste of. If I was going to have a gluten-free bread, I would have the almond bread that is called sandwich bread, and the recipe is in Ilana Amsterdam's excellent cookbook called The Gluten-Free Almond Flour Cookbook. You can find that on Google, Amazon. It's all over the place. She made one glaring mistake in there, which I've spoken to her about. She understands it now. And one thing which is not so bad, but I would like it corrected. So if you happen to buy the Gluten-Free Almond Flour Cookbook, for all the marvelous recipes that are in it, you must make an important substitution. I understand that this tape is not on sweeteners, but a lot of you that are listening understand that high fructose corn syrup is a damaging sweetener. The reason is not because it's from corn. The reason is not because corn is almost all genetically modified. The reason is because we now know from a lot of research that fructose itself in a concentrated form or even just in a large form, if people eat a lot of fruit, actually promotes diabetes by promoting or causing insulin resistance. And high fructose corn syrup is a syrup that's very high in fructose. Well, it turns out that there's substance which people think is healthy, which is available in all the health food stores, and which is now being used to sweeten lots and lots and lots of things that are looked at as healthy, which in fact is not healthy. And that substance is agave nectar, A-G-A-V-E, agave nectar. Agave nectar is not at all healthy because agave nectar has equal or greater amounts of fructose than high fructose corn syrup. And fructose is the reason high fructose corn syrup is bad. Agave nectar has even more. High fructose corn syrup is 50 to 52% fructose. Agave nectar is 55 to 60% and sometimes up to 95% fructose. So in her recipe book, which is a fabulous book and I love it and I respect her for writing it, every time it tells you to put in a quarter cup, a half a cup, three quarters of a cup of agave nectar, you must instead put in another syrup, so the recipes will work well, that's healthy, and that syrup is called Yacon syrup, Y-A-C-O-N. And you can read about it online. My favorite company that carries it, I believe, is called, I think, herbdealer.com, I believe, is their website. They have the least expensive, high quality. You can buy a liter at a time. Pretty expensive product, but when you can get a liter, it's cheaper. And then the other thing that I would change in that book is she often uses a grape seed oil. There aren't any cultures around the world, I believe, that have ever used grapeseed oil. And so I want a traditional fat. So I would replace the grapeseed oil. Personally, when I make the recipes, I do replace it with either coconut oil or butter or, you know, any of number of different things, olive oil. But usually I replace it with either coconut or a mixture of coconut and butter. But that's not as important. The important thing is do not use agave nectar in there. Substitute an equal amount of yacon syrup. So you can make a lot of her recipes gluten-free. They are delicious. She has cake recipes, cookie recipes. I'm not trying to promote you to eat a whole bunch of sweets. I don't like to promote the sweet tooth. But for people who are trying to have the family go gluten-free, and everybody says, I want my desserts, that's the way to do it, is to use her recipes to be able to still bring in the desserts. So we've covered a lot of the reasons that most people that are intolerant and reactant or reactive to gluten and gliadin and wheats don't know it, and why their doctor is simply ignorant of the facts and has run some tests and tells them that's not it, when in fact it may very well be it. We have covered a lot of the things that have gluten in them and how hard it can be to eliminate them. We've covered how difficult it can be because of how long you must be gluten-free in some cases to see the differences. You really need to commit and tell yourself, I need to know if the reasons I don't feel as good as I should, that I don't feel great all the time, might have something to do with gluten. You really need to say, okay, you know, I can, it's going to be very difficult, but I only want to do this once, and if I screw it up, I'm going to have to start all over. So let's be really good, and let's just 100% eliminate gluten for 2 months. That's enough for most people. I've covered, you know, how bad the tests are. I've covered how many different things, and I'm sure there are lots that I've missed, but how many different things the gluten intolerance can cause in different people, you know, from emotional disorders to other neurological disorders to memory problems to gastrointestinal problems to arthritic problems to thyroid problems. There are a number of people in some of the research studies where after they had been off gluten for enough months, and in some of the cases it took being off gluten for over a year because they simply felt better anyway, their autoimmune condition, which they'd had for many, many years, which of course every doctor told them could never heal, went away because the trigger was gone long enough the body could heal itself. So I think I've covered everything about as much as I'm able at this point. There are a number of books that you can get on gluten and gliadin sensitivities, and this is a very, very important topic, and it's very difficult to get people to be willing because of how our society depends on wheat for everything, and the wheat we're using is horrible. And you really have to cut everything out for a while first. You know, if after you've done that for 2 months, you wish to bring in some emmer from Europe, and you can get it online and grind some and make your own bread and try that, you may be able to do that. But what can sometimes happen and be misleading is if you pull all the triggers out for enough months, a lot of people are able to then eat, let's say, a piece of bread or a bowl of pasta one time, and sometimes not react. And they go, wow, I've healed it. That has not been shown to be the case, because if they then start eating it again, it will rapidly come back. And now everything they did that took a long time to do has just been completely reversed. So if you wanted to be able to validate whether it was healable, which we don't know, the way to do that may be upon us shortly, because the lab that is coming out, and the new lab is called Cyrex. I believe it's C-Y-R-E-X. And they are claiming that, or the people I've spoken to that are talking about this lab are claiming that they are going to be able to monitor with their tests many different ways in which the body reacts to gluten and gliadin. So for example, I'll give you this quick example and then I'll close. For example, if you ran the Cyrex test after it became available, I'm hoping it will be available this is August, by before the end of September of 2010. If you ran that test and it showed that you were reactive, and then you stopped everything, one way to determine whether or not you have cleared all the antibodies out of your body is to rerun the test. So if you truly stayed off gluten, gliadin for, let's say, 3-4 months, you rerun some of these tests, and the tests show it's clear because it's not there anymore. The reactivity, you know, goes away and your body is now starting to heal. So that would give us the ability, if their test is as accurate as I hope it will be, I hope, for somebody to, let's say, stay off gluten for 6 or 8 months and be symptom-free for maybe the last 4 months, and then they want to know what would happen if they had gluten again. Is it possible they've cured themselves? I would say it's unlikely, but the question might be able to be answered by running that test again and seeing if it shows no antibodies anymore, if it now shows your body is fine, and then going ahead and eating some wheat product, maybe once a day for 3 or 4 days. Obviously, if any reaction comes back, bang, stop it immediately. But if you know you don't get a reaction, you have a piece of bread for, let's say, once a day for, I don't know, 1 week, 7 days, and if during those 7 days no reaction comes back, now you rerun the lab test. And if the lab test says, oh, he's reacting again, you know, nope, you weren't cured, cut it back out. So I hope this has been very helpful to you. This is David Getoff, and I love educating the public. I only hope that as many people that could greatly benefit by cutting out gluten after they've learned this, as many people as could benefit, will try cutting it out to see if they do. Thank you for listening.